This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the EU's unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content, with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector today. Join us every week as we explore what makes the EU a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech players in the world. Okay, let's roll.
Welcome to Breaking Banks Europe, episode number 2. I'm here with my two co-hosts, Matthias and Nina. Hello.
Ciao, Matteo. How are you?
Morning.
So the theme of today, and I will let Matthias in a short while introduce our guest, is fintech is not a tech game, it's a culture game. As you might guess, this is going to be a nice chat about corporate culture. And we have two guests suggested by Matthias, and I never met them, but from the looks, it's going to be a very interesting conversation. So I will let Matthias introduce our two estimated guests.
Well, thank you very much, Theo, for kicking that session off. And in particular, interested in today's topic, because being myself a manager, a CEO and a founder of a company, actually, I suffered or used culture as much as I could. And I think we shall be all very much aware of what the topic is. So that is actually why we invited two distinguished and super experienced guests today. And let me start with Chris Colbert, who is dialing in today from Seoul, but being an American himself and having European roots to be compliant with our Breaking Bank Europe's rules on the one side. So good morning or good evening, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, everybody, for allowing me to join the conversation.
Thanks for being in. And on the other side, we have Guido Beetz, who is a German, currently dialing in from Austria and being in the HR business and so to say culture business for more than 30 years now, Guido?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is how I grew up.
Wonderful. Maybe, Guido, may I ask you to start to introduce you a little bit and what you're doing, what your view maybe on culture might be?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Guido Beetz from Germany. I have a master's in leadership development. And my passion really is since 1982, by the way, where I joined a large bank as an intern even. My passion is to improve the performance of people, of leaders and of organizations. And this is where the company I founded grew around all these topics. So currently we're 60 employees and have about 200 freelancers supporting companies all over the globe in corporate culture, leadership development and all that stuff.
If you would put it in one phrase, what would be your statement on that?
You really have to be careful whom you select to work with you. And you also have to orchestrate very consciously your corporate culture.
Chris, please, if you would introduce yourself, giving us a little bit of a background, your also academia background and so on, and what your kind of first take on the culture topic is.
Sure. I've been in business for decades, running a bunch of companies, starting a bunch of companies. Most recently, I was a managing director of the Harvard Innovation Labs. And over my career, I have come to believe that all there is people, and that what separates great organizations from good organizations or bad organizations is the way of the people. Their motivation, their ability to collaborate, to create together, to challenge each other, to learn, to grow, to become, to realize their full potential, both personally and professionally. And all that is wrapped up in culture. But I also believe that culture is an end and not a means. In other words, the organizations that create culture teams to fix the culture are doomed to failure.
That in practical life means what?
It's about who you hire, how you manage, how you lead, how you motivate, how you teach. That culture cannot be turned into a project.
Okay.
You know, culture is a derivative. It's an outcome of your actions, and I guess most importantly, your behaviors as an organization. Every entity has a culture, countries, companies, cities, families, and the culture, again, is a derivative. It's a consequence of what, how the people within the entity are behaving.
I would say, first of all, there's nothing like a no culture. And second, is there something like a good or a bad culture on its own, or is that maybe then only related to the objectives you have?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think there's a good culture definition that correlates with what would be construed as high performance. However, I was just reading a New Yorker article literally this morning about Amazon. It's one of their very lengthy articles. And it's all about Amazon's culture. And you read the article and you come away thinking, my God, it is such a carefully orchestrated way of being. The rules at Amazon, the 14 leadership principles, are so explicit and so adopted by every employee that it is a material, has a material effect on the performance of the organization. The first pass after you read this article is Amazon has a good culture, maybe even a great culture that results in high performance, profit, revenue, growth, whatever. But you could also read the article and look at it through the lens of the people that work in their warehouses who are literally timed down to the nanosecond in terms of how many boxes they're moving, how many boxes they're filling. And those people are two steps away from indentured servants. So through a second lens, you know, what appears to be a good culture and a high-performing culture is actually maybe not such a positive culture. So I think it correlates with how you define success for the organization.
Guido, jump in, please.
I feel in the mood to contradict a little bit. Yeah,
sure.
Wonderful.
Because the point is, when you say it's just an end and not a means or whatever, if you're not doing this consciously, I mean, this could be the end at the end of the day.
Because, I agree with that.
Yeah, the point is, and also what I think we should not mix up is procedures or processes or whatever. And the culture, which for me is a little bit more underlying, yeah. So the culture is more the background on which you then impose or set up processes, which you have described. But I think at the end of the day, when you look at the task of a leader, even maybe a senior leader or a leader in a small pocket of the organization, the way I would define leadership is to create the environment where people can and want to perform.
Okay.
I agree with that.
This means you are sort of enabler, but you're also sort of a motivator. That's what I said in my opening statement. I think this has to be a very conscious process and not just say, okay, this is the culture that just happened, that this is the culture we came up with. It's pretty much something where you say, okay, this is what we want to achieve. What should be the culture, as I said, where people can and want to perform?
Now, if I would be listening our podcast today and I would listen to you guys saying, okay, they talk about a lot of cultural stuff, but what the heck is culture? So could we give it a definition by components or maybe by symptoms or by whatever kind of characteristic that we say, okay, that if you go back to your company, no matter whether that's a startup or whether it's an incumbent, go back to and have a look to whether you have those components, because they will drive culture. Guido and Chris, you already mentioned leadership to be a very, let me say, essential component to the whole discussion. But what else would be the culture? Is it like values to the company or what else?
If I would have to define it, I think the easiest is culture is the way we do things around here. Yeah, so this is the easy one. And at the end of the day, I think we're talking about a certain behavior that is expected, reinforced, and rewarded in this organization. So this is, from my point of view, what defines culture.
And I would just add to that I think the leadership, it's just like a family. The leadership and managers of the organization model the behavior. The organization will follow that behavior. So that's my point about it's an end, not a means, that the way of the leaders and the way of the managers and the principles they live by, the values they live by, their specific behaviors basically send a signal to the rest of the organization of what is expected, what is acceptable, you know, the way, as was said, the way of the organization.
Maybe what is really interesting, when you look at a startup in the very beginning does not have employees, they have followers. Yeah? So you have a leader with a certain idea, and then this guy creates followers who say, okay, I want to join in or whatever. But over time, the followers become employees. Yeah? And in between, you have the growing pains of an organization, and then it can go either into a problem or it can evolve.
So as indicated by Matteo in the beginning, we have a co-host today also, and I'm very happy to introduce Nina to that discussion now, in particular for one reason, and I give you a gender reason. We often see that fintech is a male topic for whatever reason, and I'm very happy to have Nina on the show now. Nina, could you share what you heard so far? Could you share a thought on this, and in particular maybe also looking fintech companies versus incumbents? Do you think incumbents also still have followers, as Guido said it?
Yeah, so I love that I'm amongst fellow academics today, so I can nerd out a little bit from my days in my master's program. But building off what was said earlier about culture and the way we do things, culture springing forth from Minerva, the leader, I was brought back to sitting in a cold lecture room at the LSE and learning about corporate culture, culture in general. And so I'm, you know, for the two academics, thinking of Shine and the way that culture to him is viewed as being multi-layered and deep. And if you can picture that iceberg, if you will. And so the way that I view it is very much three-tiered in keeping with Shine, and how on the top you have observable facts, which when comparing fintech and fintech companies and financial institutions, whether that's banks or regulators, whether that is at Klarna, when you walk into the offices, every office around the world has the same licorice pink, has the same branding, has the same chairs. You'll find, I'm sure, across the continent that many fintech companies now sort of brand their employees to a certain extent. You've got a lot of swag, you've got puffer jackets and t-shirts and socks and everything that employees can readily show that they are part of this tribe, so to speak. But then underneath that, you've got the values and norms that really are just the widely accepted behaviors of what's right and wrong, and the expectations that people should think about in their day-to-day. With that all sitting upon what I view as what's everything under the water of the iceberg of the underlying assumptions of fintech in particular, which is tends to be along the lines of building a better financial world and reimagining financial services, building a healthier financial life. Any combination of those words tends to be that vision that everyone is brought on board for, that has bought into, or quite literally and exchanged maybe salary for equity in purpose of that vision. So having worked both at a scheme, for example, having worked at MasterCard and working at FinTech, we're now, I think, I wonder if you would all agree, moving into a space where the incumbents, whether banks or schemes, are realizing how important culture is, and they are modeling that in their behavior as well, I view it. So yes, it's all very well and good sometimes to see fintechs offering beer and having dogs in the office, and everyone works at WeWork, who, yeah, by the way, has their own culture problems, undoubtedly. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. But before we come to Matteo, absolutely. And actually, dogs, we at Feeder had a very strong discussion whether we should have dogs in the office. And I can tell you, after the first rainy day, that discussion was over, because in a big office, the dog suddenly is dominating the smell in the office. So actually, that's not too easy. But Nina, actually, given the fact that you're working at Klarna, and I think all of us, like Chris and Guido, we have a lot of incumbent, and in particular also Matteo, we have a lot of incumbent experience as well. You know, whenever I come to those places of young companies and startups and fintechs, isn't, I find it to be whatever kind of ridiculous if, you know, you're not becoming innovative and rule breaking by having a table tennis in the office. Isn't that overrated?
I absolutely agree.
The bike placed at the ball or on the ball in the office, and everybody feels suddenly very cool. But in their heart, they're still very old school and fashion. By the way, I met a lot of young people being extremely old in their mind. So the place.
Are you talking about me? Being old in my mind?
No. I'm not talking. I'm only talking about non-present people, you know. So
I am a bit of an old soul, but I completely agree. And that, you know, what I said before, that the top of the iceberg there is the observable facts, right? So yes, maybe there is a difference between walking into Deutsche Bank and walking into N26, and what you see on the walls will be different. But I think you have to think about what is the leadership modeling, what is written into the DNA of the company itself. If everyone does subscribe to the belief that they are building a better financial world, your hope is that they are doing so also with morals and ethics in mind, and everything that they do in action is pulling that ship towards that direction. Whether or not that is the case, sometimes I wonder, because we talk a lot about, you know, fintech companies bringing around the revolution in financial services. And yet sometimes I look from the outside into some businesses and wonder if perhaps we have built the same exact thing that we had before with a better tech stack, but with the same culture.
Yeah.
That is super interesting, yeah. Matthias, First of all, I want to salute the fact that, you know, Nina, you're particularly sharp for being 6:15 a.m. today for you. So I want to salute that.
Always sharp as a razor.
And also, I wanted to add, you know, to Matthias, maybe that I almost regret today to be a host and not a guest, because actually 2 days ago, my book mainly about corporate culture came out, and it's called actually Talent and Rebels, Dealing with Corporate Misfits. And the last thing I want to do is, of course, you know, making a promotion for it. But it's all about openness. It's all about openness. So don't come on. Be nice with me. It is actually very much fitting this conversation, because to me the coolness in incumbents is lipstick on a pig. And I'm talking about, you know, someone who is called very often, like, you know, probably all of us, to talk into these large players, that actually they want to imitate this coolness, almost like something that they had to, out of fear, maybe, but not really out of true openness. And this is, you know, I would like to actually pull back the conversation into this. Matthias, what do you think?
Yeah, well, of course. Openness, I would say, is one part of living a culture. And as we heard in the beginning, there is no culture. And if the culture of a company is, for instance, living on the base of a black box decision-making and on a need-to-know basis communication, it is a very specific culture. It might be even the case that in certain circumstances, that might be the best way of achieving the envisaged goal. Guido, I that might be, for instance, Guido, you've been 10 years, 12 years at the German military. would you say that was a very collaborative environment and a need to know, more like a need to know basis, isn't it? So
it's more collaborative than you might think.
Maybe I have a different memory to the whole thing.
Yeah. No, the point is, at the end of the day, it's teamwork. Yeah. And it's learning. It's especially a very high culture with failures. Yeah. Where at the end of the day, you wouldn't say it's a failure. You always would call it a try. Yeah. So we tried something. It didn't work. So we have to try better. And I think one of the mantras in startup is, if you fail fast, So the military always says fail different. Yeah. So don't repeat the same mistakes again and again. Yeah. So and it's really about trying. But I think the military takes us a little bit away from what I would like to discuss here. Sure. Yeah. Because my point is what I would like to draw the discussion a little bit to is a term which is called toxic leadership. Yeah. As I said before, I think it's the leader's duty to create this environment where people can and want to perform. But in a lot of cases, and I think this is what Chris also said, that we have role models that you say, okay, they come with their values, we want to follow them or whatever. But in a lot of cases, you have something like leaders misbehaving. Yeah, so you don't have to talk about Uber now or others. There are some really interesting cases over the last years. Yeah, where you see that the behavior of certain leaders almost destroyed companies. Yeah, and I think the importance of decent leadership behavior is absolutely vital. And I think you all know this nice sentence: people join companies and leave bosses. Yeah? And yeah. This is where some toxic leaders really can ruin the culture of a company.
That's a very good one. Matteo, I think as much as I look to the time, we have to do our break now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I would say let's stop for a couple of minutes and let's continue the discussion after the break.
We're back from our break and we are in the middle of the discussion regarding corporate culture, the pros and cons. Is there is something like a non-culture existing? What is a good or bad culture, maybe? And maybe let me kick off the second half of our discussion by trying to summarize what components to a culture might be as a learning out of the first 30-minute discussion. So I take a strong emphasis on leadership. So leadership can make a culture happen, yes or no. Or a supportive culture, let me say by that, yes or no. We've discussed that culture cannot be ordered on the one side, it is a result on the behavior, but on the other side, as Guido mentioned it, we should aim for a specific culture and not just let it happen. I think, as Nina said it, what is in particular also relevant is that there is a vision. I think we all agree that values, certain values in a company make a culture, yes or no, or drive it. We spoke about remuneration schemes and salary that could be a component to that culture, maybe by incentivation or kind of not punishment, but disincentives. We spoke about the location. Is a cool table tennis and a bike on the ball already a cool culture? And does that make this company successful or not? And we spoke about practices. Now, adding all this up, Chris, and coming to a regulatory environment and speaking about failure, allowing to failure and fail fast. Do we think that a regulator allows us in a regulated company to fail fast? Or isn't actually the regulator maybe hindering us to create this kind of collaborative, open and fail fast culture by saying you may not fail?
I don't know. I actually have a couple of things I want to share. Answer to the question is I don't think it's binary. I don't think regulated companies, banks, whatever, where they are, I'm doing some work with a couple of them and they're so holding on to the past and they're so not embracing the truth of the need to change, the need to innovate, the need to take a little bit more risk. And I would argue that, sure, in a highly regulated environment, you're probably never going to realize the level of call it an innovative culture like an Amazon or a Google, but there's a lot of space between where those guys are and where most regulated companies are. And I do believe also that regulators are beginning, the more enlightened regulators are beginning to understand that some of these walls have to come down, or if not come down, they have to be shortened.
I think what we learn out of maybe other industries like the car industry and maybe of the Boeing example is that in the Dieselgate scandal is that a certain corporate culture did actually prohibit open communication about technical failures.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The thing I wanted to two other quick things. One is, do you guys familiar with the term unwritten rules?
Yeah, kind of informal rules. Yes.
Well, not even informal. Okay. Actually, unwritten, undeclared, unspoken, may or may not correlate with the values that have been declared, but they end up being the guardrails or the guidelines for how the organization behaves, and they tend to be created over time. And right. It's a really interesting exercise to do with a leadership team to ask them, what are the unwritten rules of the organization? Because I think
provide an example for us
of what an organization's unwritten rules are.
Yeah, maybe a quick one for the audience.
Sure, I was working with a company probably 5 years ago now that was attempting to become a higher performing organization. It was certainly not that. And I had an offsite with the six executive team members, and I asked them each to write down the unwritten rules of the organization, as many as they wanted. And then I combined all the results and I put them up on a whiteboard, checking off the ones that matched. And the number one matched answer to the question, what are the unwritten rules, was distrust before trust.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Not a good look.
Not a good look.
They were reading Stalin, yeah?
Yeah. And they were all, what was odd is that they were all both shocked and not shocked, and they also understood that they were the ones that were perpetuating that rule. Right? Back to your leadership point.
Yeah.
These behaviors are derivative of leaders.
Yep.
And if the leaders are acting a certain way, it's likely that, you know, the rest of the organization will act a certain way.
Matthias, I think the point that you made earlier, though, is completely pertinent, whether it is we're talking about regulated industries such as car manufacturing, or right now, what we see with Facebook, for example, just to call out the obvious, where they were literally the ones who started the whole phrase move fast and break things. Well, right. That's all well and good to move fast and break things until you break democracy, isn't it? And so we see something, I think, different as we also discuss a lot TechFin and a lot of the tech players. Uber announced yesterday that they're launching Uber Money, and a lot of tech players are coming into financial services, but by so doing, they are actually entering into a highly regulated industry. And so I'm very personally interested to see how they excel or are hampered by that regulation. I think a lot of times, I mean, I'm still pinching myself that the European Commission even passed through PSD2 because it seems so innovative and so ahead of its time, especially compared to the US. But you do have regulators like the FCA with sandboxes that they are trying to be more open about opening that up and allowing playgrounds and sandboxes for fintech companies to thrive. But I wonder in what ways the incumbents are taking advantage of that and using that to play as well.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And also raising the topic of Facebook, we had the other day, we had a panel on which I had the honor to participate and talking about data ethics and data compliance. And of course, that comes also back to the underlying corporate culture, because we spoke about the values in it. And once you do not have, for instance, we protect democracy as a value, I would say, and I'm happy to discuss that. Once you do not have that as a value, and your only value is we do monetize the data we get under control to a maximum, once that is the value, we should not be surprised about whatever kind of an outcome we currently see. And the company we speak about should not be surprised that actually the trust level towards that company is in the negative. In the same time, I experience a lot of fintech companies coming around by being innovative by breaking law, you know, which is not what we should go for. Yeah. We've seen that quite often, didn't we? And in the same time, I see incumbent companies being not innovative, not customer-centric, with the excuse of the regulators not allowing that. And that's a really excuse. So Guido, what do you think about that?
I would like to differentiate a little bit between, let's say, something like research development, innovative ideas, and operations. I think the moment where you're just developing, experimenting, or whatever, playing around with stuff, I think there you need absolutely freedom to think whatever is possible. But there comes the moment when all the ideas you have go into operations. And this is, from my point of view, where the regulators come in and say, okay, you developed in your great corporate culture a super good idea, but we're just not allowing you to implement this now. Yeah, but so I would differentiate.
Then it's not a good idea. Then it's a shitty idea, to be honest. If I develop something I cannot execute later in my environment, then it's not a good idea, to be very open. If I cannot apply it. But Nina, Klarna wouldn't be, and I know the founders and so on, so Klarna on the one side, as Feeder in the old days, was regulated, right? And is regulated. And still saying, okay, we are innovative and we are customer centric. So these are your golden kind of rules and values you have in the company. Otherwise, I think, how would you explain Klarna's success then?
Absolutely. Well, Klarna is a regulated bank.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so we do have to operate within those confines. But I think, for example, with the Klarna card that was launched in Germany recently, we were able to circumvent post-identity for the KYC processes. And we did that with the help of open banking. Okay. I think it's really interesting in the way that Klarna is set up, and the way that we're kind of given direction is to attack the problem as opposed to each other. And so a lot of times as well, we'll have teams that come together, kind of leap teams that come together to solve a particular problem. And it's everyone in that group is insanely focused and quite passionate to a point where it's almost ridiculous about whatever topic is at hand, whether that is a new user flow, whether that's improving the customer journey, whatever it is. I think that is something that has been instilled in us from the top, from Sebastian down, the way that he speaks about the company, the way that, actually a really great example of this is every year we do what's called Smooth Week. And we all get together and we have a bit of an expo. So if you can imagine like the Money 2020 Hall in Vegas right now, but then shrink it down to just the one company. And every team basically has a miniature stand and they have to present what they've worked on in the past year, maybe what they're looking forward to working on. And, you know, a lot of people are going, that's insane that you would bring so many people together. But we do it every year, and every year it kind of revitalizes everyone, energizes everyone. They come together. I mean, I was like a kid in a candy shop learning about our DevOps and learning about our penetration testing, about our open banking team, our marketing teams, being in that one room around everyone. But then you have Sebastian come on stage, or David Sams from our CMO, and the way that they talk about the company, the way that they talk about their vision, you just feel that, I mean, it's almost cult-like, honestly. Everyone believes in what they're building and moving forward into that together. All while, of course, having to do our, you know, I'm still reminding myself I have until November 30th to finish my all the regulatory and compliance testing that we have to do as people that work in financial services. I think it's interesting, as we keep alluding to, we keep going back to this idea of culture springing from the leader. And I think, if I may as well, it's not just fintech. I've seen in incumbent organizations, MasterCard, for example, has a brilliant leader in Ajay Banga, for example. They may not have always been thought as spry and fintech and fun to work at, but the way that they set the tone with new leadership, I think, really sets up the environment for everyone else to succeed or conversely to fail.
And Nina, just to take one end, actually, because I really loved listening to you and it raised a very relevant thought, I think, in my mind is when a corporate culture is becoming too dominant, maybe too positive, people are maybe too overwhelmed by it. And Chris, maybe that's a question for you. Isn't it the danger that such a corporate culture becomes a religion, actually, which might be at a certain peak point counterproductive to the whole thing?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I see Guido and Chris nodding their heads as well. I think I wouldn't be out of bounds to say that sometimes I walk around London. Recently I was in Berlin. I worked in Vienna. I've worked in Paris. You go into the tech scene and you're sucked into almost cultish behavior. You know, they don't know why they're doing things sometimes. So there is such a thing as where you're so blindly invested into it that you just keep pulling and you don't know why. And this is a lot of the times what you mentioned earlier with Volkswagen, you have the same exact problem where it's, well, this is just how we do things. And so I'm not going to mention the fact that this doesn't work with Boeing as well. I'll pass it over to the gentleman.
Yeah, Guido, you wanted to say something, and then Chris, please raise.
I think what is dangerous if you become a sect, which really keeps every other thoughts out. But one of my favorite business authors, Jim Collins, when he did his research about companies that are really built to last, one of the findings he had was that all really sustainable companies, it's what he described as cult-like cultures. Yeah. Okay. So you either love the guys or you hate them. There's nothing in between.
But Chris, please, couldn't such a cult-like culture develop some very dangerous dynamics, actually?
Yeah, well, back to the New Yorker article, there's a clear reference or consideration of Amazon and Bezos as having created a cult. And you can see as you read the article that the negative attributes that are beginning to bubble up. So I think the answer is yes. The cult can get you a long way, but it can also maybe turn on you. There's actually an interesting bit from history that years ago, a guy did a study on empires and determined that every empire follows the same six stages: pioneer, conquest, commerce, affluence, intellect, and decadence. And intellect and decadence is where the cult dimension starts rearing its head, when the organization believes, or the country believes, it has it all figured out, that, you know, it's optimized. And then it starts losing contact or touch with the customer, with the market, with some of its own employees. That was also reflected in the Amazon piece. So yeah, I think the cult thing is both an aspiration and something to worry about.
And as a shareholder, I might be also worried, as I actually would be relying too much to one person only. You know what I mean? As positive as I see a central leadership person, and if I may say so, I suffered it, and I was supported by that the same way. As much as I actually experienced to have one great person that drives the vision, that kind of makes everybody move and is the brand of the company, as much as I have that on the one side, I would regard it to be a risk. Chris, wouldn't you agree on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and it goes back to what's a good culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, a cult of personality culture is probably not a good culture. And a culture that is more oriented towards distributed leadership, you know, sort of implicit succession planning, where there is no single individual that is sort of defining the rules of the game or reinforcing the rules of the game, that is, you know, arguably, or, you know, maybe obviously, I think a healthier thing to aspire to. But it's also hard to do. I mean, I've run companies most of my life, and distributing that cultural leadership, that behavioral norm among all the leaders is hard to do, but it's the right thing.
Maybe Nina, because we are running out of time now, and last question, Nina. You know, one of the big topics we currently discuss up and down in conferences is whether incumbents and innovative companies like fintech companies really can cooperate or collaborate, or whether it's not feasible for cultural reasons. What is your take on that?
Oh my goodness, I'm having flashbacks to last year's Money 2020 EU stage. I think, you know, we get on stage and we talk about collaboration. I think perhaps the fear has subsided with the incumbents, and I mean, that remains to be seen. But what's interesting is, and I think I'm looping us full circle back to where we began when we talked about culture being something that is done with intention. When you set up an innovation team or a digital team, and this is not knocking those teams because I have many, many dear friends that work on these teams. But when you set up a team like that, that has a P&L that does not affect the wider business, that, you know, reports God knows where, that is actually, they're saying, oh, we're building something greenfield. And so they're in a special loft space or a WeWork away from the company. A lot of times that culture that they're creating is great, but that's the innovation team's culture. And that's not the culture necessarily of the bank.
It's so just relocating the problem, isn't it?
Exactly. So when push comes to shove, it's, you know, it's no wonder that it's like you're introducing a virus into the body of the bank when all of a sudden they reject everything that's going on, whether that's through the procurement cycle or as it comes further down the line when you finally meet the army of compliance officers that you have within a bank,
procurement.
For example.
I'm just mentioning procurement.
Yeah, so, you know, there are a lot, the graveyard of procurement, as Dr. Lita Glick dislikes to call it. And so I think there is opportunity, but I would love to see quite physically having a fintech company come in to the offices of a bank, bring in people that aren't on innovation teams. And I think it's a little bit of stakeholder management as well, where you have to make sure that everyone on board is on board and they're rowing in the same direction, because you can say, yes, we're onboarding a new open banking platform. It's being provided by this technical provider. And then someone down the line goes, actually, I think that's quite shit and we're not going to do that. So what have you done? You've set yourself up. You have a proof of concept that ultimately fails because someone poo-poos it down the line. I'd like to see more of it succeed, obviously, selfishly. But I think that remains to be seen.
I can't believe me, and I think everybody knows, or the most of you know, that I would have a lot to contribute to exactly that discussion, which I definitely will not do because this show is not my therapy session. now, having coming closely to the end of our today's show, actually, Chris, and it's always unfair to then start with somebody, I know. But in a, let me say, kind of final summarizing statement, and thinking it out of the shoes of our listeners, what would you give me, and I will ask you, Guido as well, and Dina, please as well, what would you give me as a kind of advice to be a, I would say, maybe cultural sensitive leader or entrepreneur? What kind of an advice would you give me as a takeaway for today?
As the leader of the company or a participant in the company?
Well, whatever you would love to go now.
I mean, the easier answer is the leader. The leader has to look at it's a correlation between the behaviors they want to see exhibited in their company and their own behaviors. I mean, this is my point about, you know, we can do a value session and write down a bunch of words on a page, but if the leadership of the organization is not exhibiting those values won't stick. They won't become the way of the organization. And so there's this honest conversation that the leader has to have with who they are, how they are, the kind of organization they want to create, and ensuring that the way they behave aligns with the outcome that they're after. And so and I mean,
what the words they say,
the actions they take,
yeah,
the body language they use, you know, the organization watches every move of the leadership team.
What you're saying would be the kind of old proverb saying walk the talk, isn't it? And maybe do not request more that than you would be willing to deliver yourself. Is that kind of a formula you could?
Yeah, I mean, behave the way you want the organization to behave. I mean, it's that simple, but it's not real.
It seems to be a very obvious point, actually, but having my own experience, I would say a lot of people should have now carefully listened. Thank you, Chris. So Guido, actually, and let me jump on the differentiation question by Chris. I would ask you to have a look out of the middle management, because I regard the middle management to be a very critical component to any cultural effort in a company, because I would say the leader can do whatever he or she wants. If the middle management is not following that, and if the middle management is kind of more or less blocking that, or let it kind of let him talk, let her talk, and in 2 weeks it's different. What is the middle management's takeaway, or actually self-understanding, self-awareness in cultural topics? What could you give us to that?
I would have two important points. One is that when you select people either to be promoted or to join the company, I really, really would focus on attitude, because skills you always can train. But if you select the wrong people, this will impact your culture very heavily. So the second point for my view is that you really have this job to create environments, and you have to do this by purpose. And of course, coming back to what Chris said, you have to be authentic. So if you just do a greenwash of your culture, saying, okay, this is so we want to save the world and whatever, but at the end of the day, we just want to make money in my very specific pocket, people will find this out very soon. So you have to be really authentic and look for the right fit. And you have to allow people really to contribute. And we did this in a lot of companies where we just created sessions where you crowdsource internal ideas and then really give people a voice. And this is where you always get them on board.
Guido, that means also that the middle management cannot say and state, well, culture is not my topic, it's actually the leadership. Outsourced culture to the leaders.
Very, very good point. There is not the culture. You usually have a company as a very nice subset of different subcultures. So you might have corporate culture, but the subculture, let's say, in the purchasing department is completely different maybe from the advertising department or from IT or whatever. And this is something leaders have to be very conscious that there is not the corporate culture, which can be an umbrella or whatever, but what kind of culture do I create in my teams, in my area of accountability?
Thank you so much. Nina, well, finally, Nina, so wrapping it up, And we had a brief kind of tour to the gender topic. How relevant, as a kind of closing note from your end, how relevant is a gender awareness actually when it comes to corporate culture? I know that's a show on its own, I know, and it's a particular unfair question, but I want to take advantage of you being a woman, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, I, for most of my career, have stepped into roles as the first woman on a team. And I think that's a step forward. As many of my mentors say, it used to be, they say, you complain because now you're not sitting at the table, but you're in the room. And they say, well, don't complain. We used to not even be in the room. So we are progressing. I think really to go back to what both Guido and Chris have said, it's about baking it in from the beginning. It's not about putting lipstick on a pig, as Matteo had said earlier. It's, you know, no one wants to bake a cake without eggs in it and then throw eggs on top at the end. It doesn't make sense. It won't taste good. You need to have it baked in from the beginning. And so, you know, it's really easy to throw around words like diversity, inclusion. I'm always impressed by those companies that are making an effort to try and change that. A lot of it can be seen as lip service, you know, lipstick service, yeah. Really. Yeah. Look at us, we're trying so hard, but I'd like to see more of it, obviously. We could have a whole other episode on that. I think also, though, as we talk about culture and how that affects the business, I think ultimately having a more diverse workforce creates a better product, creates a better, more inclusive culture. And so that's great for your business. And who doesn't love that?
Wonderful. So looking to the time running, actually, I want to thank everybody for participating in the show. Let me start with Chris. Thank you so much for staying up late at night. And
you're quite welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Guido, actually, for jumping in and contribute to the show. Thanks to Matteo, our host. And thank you, Nina, for enriching the show of the purely male show by simply already your presence. I think culture. Thank you so much. And I think we did a good job. As soon as everybody understood after those 60 minutes that, as Nina, as you said, culture is something that you need to integrate from the very beginning. It's not the eggs that you put on top of the cake once the cake is finished. It must be in it as a recipe from the very beginning on. And I think I really hope that we created this kind of invitation to be culture aware and having a look to cultural components to the daily work environment we are working in. Thank you so much, everybody. That was a session of Breaking Banks Europe, and we spoke about culture, and I hope you spread the word about our podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.